ever studied deck plans of ships sunk by great violence. Every weekend they swam among the bones of souls who had died at sea. Soon he was pressing deeper into the ocean, but charters to these places were rare, and there was a reason for that. At depths past 130 feet, people started to die. From the bends, nerve damage, deep water blackout, hallucinations, panic, and fear. Sometimes the bodies were never found. Captains shunned greenhorns like Chatterton, wannabes who didn't understand how the deep could kill. Chatterton showed up anyway, but he was in small company. Of the 10 million certified scuba divers in the United States, only a few hundred dove deeper than 130 feet. The true deep. Chatterton loved the wrecks. Twisted and bent, some collapsed on their sides. They were snapshots of moments when men had lost hope, when plans and futures and families had changed. Each wreck was different, sometimes by the day, changing with the temper of the ocean. Many divers lived for the artifacts these wrecks surrendered. Teacups, dishes, portholes, a bell. But to Chatterton, the stuff hardly mattered. To him, shipwrecks were puzzles that rewarded a man in exactly the measure to which he challenged himself. The farther a person swam into a wreck, the more of its secrets she revealed. Before long, Chatterton was seeing things no one had seen before. Much of what made him special happened before he arrived at the dock. He prepared relentlessly, studying deck plans, rehearsing scenarios, and imagining the shipwreck not as a structure, but as a story, one with a beginning, a middle, and an end. By seeing the ship's final moments unfold in his mind, he could see how she broke, and that meant he could move into places that had ceased being places. He could reach areas accessible only to those who could see backward in time. Soon, he felt ready to challenge the Andrea Doria, by many accounts the most dangerous shipwreck in American waters. Sunk in 1956 after colliding with the MS Stockholm off Nantucket Island, the massive Italian passenger liner lay on her starboard side in 250 feet of water. The ship's interior was deep, dark, and dangerous. Narcosis and the bends could result from the slightest mistake. Passageways and staircases were twisted and disorienting. Silt and particulate reduced visibility, sometimes to mere inches. The Doria had a reputation for giving divers whatever room they needed to kill themselves inside. Before long, Chatterton was venturing into areas on the Andrea Doria and other great wrecks no other diver had dared. To him, the risk was the point. If he went somewhere easy, he knew what he'd find there, and how could a person look forward to that? By 1991, some were calling Chatterton the greatest wreck diver they'd ever seen. Charter Captain Bill Nagel paid him the ultimate compliment. "When you die, no one will ever find your body." In the summer of 1991, Nagel got a tip from a fisherman about a possible shipwreck located 60 miles off the New Jersey coast. He called Chatterton, and they made a plan to check it out. The trip would cost several hundred dollars in fuel alone, and the odds of finding anything important were almost nil. But to Chatterton and Nagel, a man had to look. Who were you if you didn't go look? They recruited a dozen other divers, each of whom paid $100 to help defray costs, and made their way to the site. Scuba tanks strapped to his back, Chatterton descended 230 feet to the bottom by himself, where he discovered a mostly intact World War II German U-boat. Chatterton knew his ocean, and he knew his history. There was not supposed to be a U-boat within a 100-mile radius of this location. Wreck divers dreamed of finding a virgin U-boat. To discover one in American waters was the Holy Grail. All that remained was for the divers to identify the wreck, and they would make history. When the team returned to the site, however, a diver died on the bottom, his body swept away by currents. Chatterton and the others risked their lives looking, but they couldn't find the man. The tragedy hung heavy over the group. Nagel moved to replace the fallen diver with Richie Kohler, owner of a local glass business and a member of the Atlantic Wreck Divers, a notorious gang of tough guys who wore matching skull and crossbones jackets and raised hell on shipwrecks across the eastern seaboard. Kohler and his crew were accomplished divers, but they were everything Chatterton despised. They seemed to care for nothing but artifacts, risking their lives to get a 20th teacup when they'd already bagged 19. They mooned passing dinner cruises, used stuffed animals for skeet shooting targets, leaped naked into the water. They returned to the same wrecks to do the same things over and over, and for that, Chatterton dismissed them out of hand. If anything, Kohler detested Chatterton even more. "Who is this uptight asshole talking about excellence and art?" Kohler would ask. He knew Chatterton was an exceptional diver, but believed him to be missing the point. Shipwreck charters were supposed to be about fun, camaraderie, brotherhood. Without that, the sport became labor, and weekends weren't made for that. "Imagine the life this guy leads," Kohler told his buddies. "Fuck him and the boat he came in on." Over Chatterton's protests, Nagel brought Kohler aboard the U-boat project. Working separately, Chatterton and Kohler pressed into the submarine, where they encountered hanging pipe and wire and conduit, any bit of which could have entangled and trapped them inside the wreck. Dead ends and tangled passageways. And live explosives ready to detonate from a single wayward touch. Throughout the wreck, they found the remains of 56 German sailors, some of them still dressed, their shoes laid out on the floor, left, right, left, right. But no proof of the U-boat's identity. The two men began working together, not just underwater, but in government archives, at libraries, with historians and diplomats, and on the phone with old U-boat aces. Slowly, they began piecing together a history different from the official accounts, and they began to understand each other. As months turned into years, they did groundbreaking work, but came to realize that until they found conclusive proof inside the wreck itself, their theories about the submarine's identity were just a best guess, and neither of them had come this far, risked his life, to say, probably. For Chatterton and Kohler, it came down to this. A person could have theories about who he was, he could make predictions about what he might do in a given situation, but he'd never really know until he was tested. For Chatterton and Kohler, the U-boat was their test. The U-boat was their moment. So they continued to return to the wreck, spending money they didn't have on fuel and expenses, taking time from their families. Two more divers, a father and son, died while diving the U-boat. Time and again, Chatterton and Kohler might have moved the bones of the fallen sailors or reached inside the dead men's clothes to search for a pocket watch or cigarette lighter engraved with the submarine's identity. Those items sometimes survived for decades in a cold underwater environment. But neither diver was willing to do that. Swimming among the human remains, Chatterton and Kohler began to see these dead sailors not just as enemies, but as someone's sons or brothers. Or fathers or husbands. Young guys whose country was being destroyed by a madman and whose families never knew where they had died. Searching the bodies would have required disturbing the remains. So Chatterton and Kohler let the bodies rest. Their decision raised the risk that they too would die inside the wreck, but they were on the verge of doing something beautiful and would have rather lost their lives than do it in an ugly way. They kept searching. Soon, only Chatterton, Kohler, and a few others remained on the project. Chatterton began pressing into the most dangerous corners of the wreck, places so cramped and strewn with hanging debris, it was hard for the eels who lived inside to find a way out. But with every dive, he seemed only to drift further from an answer. At home, marriages grew distant and strained. To save his family, Kohler quit the U-boat and hung up his dive gear. By 1995, Chatterton found himself at a crossroads unlike any he'd known. He had unleashed all of himself on the U-boat, all that he knew about diving and life, and he was failing. In a fury of protest, he discovered and identified several new wrecks, enough to make any other diver's career, but he only sank further into despair. By 1996, his marriage to Kathy was over. He was nearly broke, and Nagel, whom he adored, had died a broken man. When people tried to console Chatterton, he told them, "I no longer know who I am." But by 1997, Kohler had sorted out his family issues and returned to the project. Chatterton devised a final plan to identify the U-boat, one that incorporated all his principles for living, and that Kohler felt certain would be deadly. Slithering inside a room that looked impossible to exit, Chatterton freed a supply box that held a key piece of evidence, then found he'd run out of air. Holding his breath, he pushed the box through a narrow opening to Kohler, then removed his tank and made a desperate swim for his partner. A few moments later, the supply box gave up its secret, and the U-boat had its name. The journey had cost 6 years, 3 lives, 2 marriages, and 2 life savings. But Chatterton had his answer. In the spring of 1998, a friend invited Chatterton to a party at a hotel in Manhattan, promising good food and the chance to meet a woman he knew. Chatterton hated formal wear and fix-ups, but he liked his friend and said he would go. That Saturday night, he pulled up to the hotel on his burnt orange Harley-Davidson Road King and left his keys with the valet. Inside, he was introduced to Carla Madrigal, a 46-year-old operational systems manager for a major commercial airline based in Washington, D.C. She was pretty in the way Chatterton liked, naturally and without trying too hard, slender with light freckles and high cheekbones, and wore a gold letter C that caught Chatterton's eye. They talked for hours, hardly noticing the others. At the end of the evening, Chatterton asked to see Carla again. She asked why Chatterton kept looking at her necklace. He told her about a shipwreck he'd found at a time in his life when he'd felt lost. The wreck was the SS Carolina. He knew it by finding brass letters on the fantail that spelled out the ship's name, in a font he'd never seen before. The same font as the C on her necklace. That summer, Chatterton agreed to join an elite team of American and British divers on an expedition to the HMHS Britannic, sister ship to the Titanic. Sunk off the Greek island of Chaia, the wreck lay on her starboard side in 400 feet of water, a depth at the very edge of what was possible for world-class divers. Even before it launched, the expedition was being hailed as one of the most ambitious in diving history. For his part, Chatterton would attempt to become the first diver ever to use a rebreather on Britannic. Using solenoids, sensors, and a chemical absorbent to manage exhaled gas, rebreathers allowed divers to go deeper and work more efficiently than ever before. The technology was cutting edge, but still hadn't been perfected. Several divers had died using the new apparatus. In experimenting with a rebreather during training for Britannic, Chatterton nearly lost his life more than a dozen times. On the wreck, he'd need it to function flawlessly. To many, his plan seemed suicidal. He intended to go to the boiler rooms to search for evidence as to why the ship sank so fast. If there was a scarier destination on the wreck, no one knew about it. According to deck plans, a diver would have to wriggle through a narrow fireman's tunnel, a passage so tight a person could not turn around. In deep water wreck diving, the inability to turn around was often the last experience a person ever had. Chatterton wasted little time when he got to the wreck. Dropping down into a fracture in the Britannic's bow, he found the fireman's tunnel and corkscrewed inside. It was even more narrow and tight than he'd imagined. Just inches of room to either side. He checked his depth gauge. 375 feet. Crazy deep. He moved slowly past jagged pipe, tangled wires, fallen railing, and razor-sharp coral, the worst place he'd ever been on a wreck. A single misstep, one brush against an invisible obstacle or a slip into a hanging tangle, and he would be trapped. And it would be hours before they came looking for him, if anyone knew where to come looking at all. For several minutes, he finger-crawled forward, covering more than 100 feet before he arrived at the boiler room. Chatterton checked the rebreather's handset. The screen was blank. The computer controlling the rebreather had died. Now he had no idea what oxygen concentration he was breathing, what he needed to survive, or how to keep from dying. And he didn't have a bailout tank. The tunnel was so narrow he'd left it at the anchor line. He began to say goodbye to himself. But was he supposed to just give up and scratch out a note to loved ones as he waited to drown? He'd seen others do that. He was not going to die that way. So he started adding oxygen manually. If he added too much, he could become toxic, convulse, lose his mouthpiece, and drown. If he added too little, he could pass out and drown. It would have to be a guess. He adjusted the mix and waited to see if he'd live. He stayed conscious. Now he had to get out. Unable to turn around, he began to slither backward, inching out of the tunnel in the same painstaking way he'd come in. Every instinct demanded he rush, but he knew suddenness would tangle him in the hanging web of wreckage. He emerged several minutes later, wondering if each breath would be his last. He swam to the anchor line, grabbed his open-circuit bailout tank, and began his 3-hour decompression ascent to the surface. That night, Chatterton took a taxi to a small hardware store, where he purchased hacksaw blades and a soldering gun, and went to work repairing the rebreather back in his hotel room. Smoke billowed from under his door before Chatterton put out the small fire he'd started. But in a few hours, he'd Frankensteined the rebreather back into operating form. He was back on the boat and into the wreck the next day. Chatterton made a total of 6 dives that trip. The rebreather failed on 3 of them. He never did figure out why Britannic sank so fast. But he'd gone places on the wreck thought to be impossible to reach. And though magazines published pictures from the expedition, no photographer could capture a feeling like that. In November 2000, PBS aired a 2-hour special episode of its documentary series, Nova, devoted to the mystery U-boat. Chatterton and Kohler were its stars, and it became one of the highest-rated episodes in series history. One morning, not long after it aired, Chatterton felt an egg-sized lump on his neck while shaving. A surgeon did a needle biopsy, then called later that day and asked him to come back to the office. "I'm kind of busy. Can we make it tomorrow?" Chatterton asked. He knew it was trouble when the doctor said no. At the office, the surgeon told Chatterton he had a squamous cell carcinoma. Cancer. He explained the pathology and recommended immediate surgery.
"You didn't say if it was benign or malignant."
"Malignant. You're going to need chemotherapy and radiation. You have a 50-50 chance of survival."
Chatterton went numb. He was just 49 years old. But as he got his coat to leave, he thought,
"I can live with 50-50. I can come out on the right side of that."
He started chemo shortly after the surgery, riding his Harley in the snow to the treatments, then going to his underwater construction job the same day, despite being too weak to swim. Carla joined him at chemo. She teased him about the attention the gay pharmacist lavished on him.
"I don't think anyone else shows up here in black leather," she joked,
but inside she was trembling. After chemo, Chatterton began radiation, 5 times a week for 2 months. By the end, he could not lift his diving helmet. But doctors were cautiously optimistic. Fingers crossed, Chatterton would make it. A few weeks later, he was supervising a big job in Battery Park City in downtown Manhattan. This work site was different from the usual water locations. It was underneath the World Financial Center, across West Street from the World Trade Center. Chatterton was in his company's trailer on September 11, 2001. When he heard a roar and then an explosion, he opened the door and looked up, where he saw an orange and black fireball shooting out of the side of the North Tower of the World Trade Center. He ran back into the trailer as debris began raining down on the corrugated tin roof. When those sounds finally stopped, he went back outside and into a world of mayhem and screams. He helped 4 Japanese tourists who were covered in blood. Dead bodies were everywhere. Chatterton ran 50 yards to the communications shack and got on the radio. He had 10 divers in the water and needed to get them out. He ordered the men to drop everything and return to the dive station. Then he ran back outside.
After all his divers got out of the water, one of them pointed to the south tower.
Here comes another one!
Chatterton saw the second plane hit and human shapes falling from the tower. By now the fire department had taken over Chatterton's trailer and made it their command post. A short time later, the south tower fell onto the trailer, killing five of New York City's top firefighters inside. Nearby, a man flailed in the river. Chatterton and his divers ran and pulled the man out. For the next several hours, Chatterton helped people onto the ferry boats until there were no more boats coming in. He boarded the last one to leave that day and looked back over a broken New York. In New Jersey, he found a ride to his condo and called Carla, who was in Argentina on business. She started crying and told him she had watched it all on television. She had feared the worst, but never got the sense that he'd died, only that he'd been helping people, and she told him she loved him. Chatterton returned to work a few weeks later, but his heart wasn't in it. The commute was bad, the memories bitter, and he was spending more time in management than in the water. He married Carla in January 2002. Then he hatched a plan. He would become a history professor. He'd taken a few college courses after Vietnam and had come to love the subject after diving so many historic shipwrecks. He enrolled at Keene University in New Jersey and quit his job as a commercial diver. It had been a 20-year run, but for Chatterton, the challenge was gone. He got straight A's his first semester and was ready to start a second when he received a call from cable television's History Channel. They were developing a show about shipwrecks and were looking for hosts. Days later, he and Kohler, once the archest of enemies, found themselves auditioning as a team. Producers liked them and ordered 8 episodes. The show would be called Deep Sea Detectives, and the premise was simple. Each week, the two divers would investigate a shipwreck-related mystery, doing research on land and diving the wreck underwater. Chatterton's powerful baritone would be perfect for the narration. The show began airing in 2003 and was a hit from the start. Chatterton filmed between classes, but the schedule was tough on Kohler's family and business, so Kohler quit after 8 episodes. He was replaced by 35-year-old Michael Norwood, a handsome and accomplished British diver who had on-screen chemistry with Chatterton. Chatterton and Norwood became fast friends. In December 2003, the show went to Palau, an island nation in the West Pacific, to investigate the USS Perry, a World War II warship sunk in 270 feet of water. The hosts would be joined by cameraman Danny Crowell, an experienced diver and a veteran of the U-boat adventure. At the wreck site, Crowell moved down the anchor line, followed by Norwood and Chatterton. Near the bottom, Norwood motioned with his hand across his throat, the out-of-air signal, which seemed strange to Chatterton. They'd been in the water for just a few minutes. A moment later, Norwood's regulator fell out of his mouth. Chatterton immediately replaced it with his own backup regulator. Norwood started breathing the gas, but he was lethargic and his eyes were confused. Chatterton began trying to help Norwood up the line. He signaled and waved and pulled on him, but nothing he did got through. Chatterton and Crowell struggled to get Norwood back to the surface. They began dragging him up the line, but Norwood's left hand was clenched so tight on the rope it was difficult to move him. They pried his fingers loose, muscling Norwood up a few feet at a time. A minute later, he stopped breathing, and this time his eyes stayed open. No fear or panic in them, just staring straight into forever. A moment later, Norwood began sinking, his lungs filling with water. Norwood's life now depended on reaching the surface. Rushing him up would likely inflict a lethal case of the bends, but he was drowning, so Chatterton inflated his friend's buoyancy compensator and sent him streaking up toward the boat. He and Crowell dropped back down to allow nitrogen to dissipate from their bodies. An agonizing but necessary wait. Chatterton prayed that when he surfaced, he would find Norwood drinking a beer and telling a joke. The guy could really tell a joke. But he'd seen Norwood's eyes, and men didn't wake up from that. When Chatterton finally reached the boat, Norwood was lying on deck, still in his gear, but dead. A rescue swimmer had tried to administer CPR, but could do nothing to help him. Norwood was 36 years old and fit, A non-smoker. Vibrant. Chatterton stared across the water, replaying events in his mind, searching for an explanation or justification or someone to blame. But there was no blame. Norwood had done everything right. This was the 9th diving fatality Chatterton had witnessed. 9 human beings who had plans and people who loved them. And he began asking himself questions, right there on the boat. Do I want to do this anymore? Have I grown too hardened to these fatalities to see what's really going on? Is diving worth dying for? But by now he knew how he'd answer once the shock lifted. No one lives forever. A person has to be who he is. I'm a diver. The authorities in Palau attributed the death to a heart attack, but that was just a guess. When Chatterton returned to the States, he and Carla agreed that they should move to Maine to keep an eye on Norwood's widow, Diana. Christmas felt different that year. In less than 3 years, Chatterton had battled cancer, watched the World Trade Center towers collapse around him, and lost a close friend in his arms. As revelers rang in 2004, he made an addendum to his principles for living. Do it now. Tomorrow is promised to no one. To Chatterton, Norwood's passing meant the end of deep-sea detectives, but the History Channel renewed the series, eventually bringing Kohler back as co-host. In the summer of 2004, Shadow Divers, my book about Chatterton and Kohler's efforts to identify the U-boat, became a bestseller and was published in several languages. Deep-sea detectives continued to earn excellent ratings, and the Nova episode ran often on PBS. In less than 2 years, Chatterton and Kohler had gone from working-class unknowns to world-famous scuba divers. The television series continued into late 2005 when the History Channel decided not to renew. The show had run for 5 seasons and 57 episodes, but its end left Chatterton, for the first time in more than 20 years, with no job. Friends and colleagues urged him to relax, catch his breath, and get out of the dive game. He was 54 now, still just 4 years removed from cancer and the World Trade Center, and too old in any case to keep making the life-risking dives he had trademarked. Instead, he devised a plan with Kohler to go to Titanic. Work on that project wrapped up in 2006. Again, friends urged him to cash in his chips and stop risking. Use your money to purchase a future, they told him. Buy a laundromat or an apartment building, something you'll just have to watch. He looked into these ideas and others. All of them made sense. None of them made him feel like John Chatterton. But what was left for a diver who had identified a mystery U-boat, done groundbreaking work on Titanic, explored the Lusitania and Britannic, mastered the Andrea Doria? Was he to dive those wrecks again? He was 55 now. If his body held up, he might have one more great adventure inside him. So, he researched other shipwrecks and called divers from around the world, and over the months assembled a list of potential dive projects, each of which would have been challenging and interesting, not one of which would have been great. He passed his days lifting weights, eating salads, and running long distances at sunrise, doing all he could to be ready when his moment came. He tried to be polite when his financial advisor suggested buying a Dunkin' Donuts franchise. Months passed that way until he met Matera in the Dominican Republic and heard stories about the great Spanish galleons, treasure ships of unimaginable value and rarity and beauty, ships no one had been able to find. To search for one, he would be required to pledge every dollar he'd saved, join forces with a virtual stranger, work in a third world country, embark on a mission that had crushed centuries of men. But as he reached over the breakfast table to shake hands with Matera, he had only one idea in his mind. Do it now. Tomorrow is promised to no one. Chapter 8. A Place Equal to the Man. Driving over the speed limit and stopping at roadside gas stations for fill-ups and heat lamp cheeseburgers,
Carla Chatterton made it from Maine to New York in time to join her husband for the last day of the dive show he was attending. Carla was always a magnet at these events, calling to passers-by to introduce them to John, manning the booths of friends, and sometimes strangers, to help pitch their products. Carla had just hours with John at the dive show, and she would do all she could to enjoy the time they had together. The months apart hadn't been easy for her. Carla and John squeezed in an hour for dinner at the hotel. His flight back to the Dominican Republic left in just a few hours. In the 7 months since the search for the Golden Fleece had begun, the couple had seen each other only a few times. Even Titanic had taken him away from home for just a month. Near the end of the meal, a young boy and his father walked up to Chatterton's table. They were fans and wanted to know what Chatterton was working on. "Can you keep a secret?" Chatterton asked. When the kid nodded, Chatterton said he was looking for a pirate ship that belonged to one of the great swashbucklers of all time. When he signed an autograph for the boy, he inscribed it, "Stay Inspired." Chatterton landed in Santo Domingo early the next morning, then set out for Samana. The road, like so much else in the Dominican Republic, was beautiful and treacherous all at once. An obstacle course of mudslides, stray dogs, and occasionally a body lying beside an overturned motorbike. Scooter and motorcycle accidents were common here. By the time Chatterton pulled up to Tony's to meet his friends for lunch, all he wanted was a cold beer. But the cooler at Tony's had fried during a blackout, and as Chatterton sat down at the table, Matera delivered sour news to go with the place's warm ale. The lower end of one of the Deep Explorer's engines had been damaged while Chatterton was away, a $5,000 repair. It would take a week or more to get a replacement part. And there was more. The magnetometer cable had shredded again. A new one had been ordered for just under $4,000. Chatterton stared at his menu. To Matera and the others, it was clear that these expenses and these frustrations were becoming too much for Chatterton, and they wondered whether this latest financial blow might push him out of the project. "I've been doing a lot of thinking about our operation," Chatterton said. "I've got to be honest with myself. And I've got to be honest with you guys." Hearts sank around the table. At least Chatterton had been man enough to come back and quit in person. "We've been looking in the wrong place," Chatterton said. "We've been thinking about this all wrong." The wreck of the Golden Fleece, he insisted, would never be found near Cayo Levantado, the island where they'd been searching for months. It didn't matter if history said she'd sunk there. It didn't matter if Bowden believed she'd sunk there. History and Bowden were wrong. "Everyone's been looking for a pirate ship," Chatterton said. "But this isn't about finding a ship. It's about finding a man." Chatterton asked the others to think hard about Joseph Bannister. In just a few years, the captain had stolen his own ship, outmaneuvered two governors of Jamaica, evaded an international manhunt, and then, despite being outmanned and outgunned, defeated the Royal Navy in battle. To do any one of those things, a man had to plan meticulously, prepare relentlessly, and demand the highest level of excellence of those around him. To do them all, he had to be great. "So we need to look for a place that's worthy of this guy," Chatterton said. And that wasn't Cayo Levantado, which is why Chatterton knew no one would ever find the Golden Fleece there. To him, Bannister had been on the mission of a lifetime. His life was at stake. He would not have chosen to put himself or his men anywhere less than perfect.
"So our job is to find that perfect place."
"What about the chart Tracy showed you where Levantado is called Bannister Island?"
Kretschmer said.
"Forget it," Chatterton said. "Wreck's not there."
"What about the Miss Universe jar?" Ehrenberg asked.
"Forget it. Wreck's not there."
"So where is it?" Kretschmer asked.
The pirate ship, Chatterton explained, was in Samana Bay. That much was certain from the treasure hunter Phipps, whose crew had spotted the Golden Fleece there just months after her sinking. But if Chatterton was right in his thinking, it would be somewhere far from Levantado, somewhere almost impossible to see. But the bay was about 25 miles wide.
There could be 100 good places for a pirate ship to careen in an area that large. To survey all of them could take years. But that didn't worry Chatterton. The team wouldn't need to search every viable location. Only the great ones. Those that were nearly invisible. "Great," Ehrenberg said. "Now we're looking for places we can't see." "Bannister got there," Matera said. "Anyone here saying we can't?" No one wanted to say that. But that still left the matter of how to handle Bowden, who seemed convinced that the Golden Fleece had sunk at Levantado, and didn't appear eager to entertain suggestions to the contrary. And Bowden was boss. His lease, his water, his pirate ship. "This is bigger than Tracy," Matera said. "If we keep doing things his way, we'll still be scratching our asses at Levantado when we're all in depends. Chatterton's right. We have to change our thinking. This is on us now." So the men made a plan. Chatterton and Matera would scout for new locations away from Cayo Levantado, but still inside Samana Bay. Ehrenberg and Kretschmer would work on repairing the Deep Explorer, and none of them would stop until they found a place that reflected Bannister's genius, a place equal to the man. At the end of lunch, as everyone walked to their cars, Matera called out to Chatterton. "John," he said, "I'm glad you're back." The next morning, Chatterton and Matera walked down to the small stony beach area beneath the villa and pushed their inflatable Zodiac boat into the bay. The 12-foot rubber craft with its hard fiberglass bottom was much like the ones used by U.S. Navy SEALs and was capable of maneuvering in depths of less than 1 foot. It was the perfect quick-hit vessel with which to zip around Samana Bay and a fine substitute while the Deep Explorer was in repair. The partner's job now was to look beyond the practical and toward the beautiful. For months, they'd limited their searches to well-hidden areas near Cayo Levantado that had good beaches for careening, excellent places for cannon defenses, and waters roughly 24 feet deep. This time, they dispensed with criteria. Instead, they would go strictly by feel. They explored inlets and bays and tiny islands on the first day, each place more scenic and unspoiled than the last. Not one of them measured up. Near sundown one day, they could see Garcia Alicante standing in the sand and waving to them in the distance. When they reached him, he delivered some news. A government contact had warned him that at least one group of treasure hunters was gearing up to search Samana Bay for the Golden Fleece. Details were sketchy, but the source said he believed these rivals to be heavy hitters who had deep pockets and government contacts of their own. "Where in Samana Bay?" Matera asked.
"Cayo Levantado. Someone watched you working out there. They think you left too early."
"You've got to be shitting me."
"No, and that's not all. They think the Golden Fleece could be one of the greatest shipwrecks ever found." "They're not going to find shit at Levantado," Chatterton said. "But I still don't want anyone in our area."
"Not on our watch," Matera said. Garcia Alicante asked how the men intended to stop it.
"I don't know yet, Victor," Chatterton replied. "I can put up with a lot, but I can't put up with thieves. No one is going to steal the Golden Fleece from Tracy, and no one is going to steal her from us."
That evening, Garcia Alicante threw a party at the villa for family and friends, as he often did on the weekends. Guests partied past midnight. The next morning, Chatterton announced that he, Ehrenberg, and Kretschmer were moving out. He gave little explanation other than to say they'd already overstayed their welcome and did not wish to take advantage of Garcia Alicante's kindness. They would be moving into a small apartment in downtown Samana. 4,000 pesos, about $100 a month, no hot water. When Matera pressed for a better explanation, Chatterton told him the all-night parties at the villa were distracting and not good for their business, which was to find the Golden Fleece. They were soon back on the Zodiac and into the bay. This time, they steered toward the outer edge of their search area, several miles west of Cayo Levantado along the northern coast. Still, they could find no perfect place for Bannister to careen. And that is how it went for the next few weeks, moving their boat into places that looked to be great, but never finding anything better than good. One afternoon, Chatterton cut the Zodiac's engine and let the boat drift on the waves. Neither he nor Matera was the type to feel sorry for himself, but each now wished for just a little of the luck that William Phipps had when he parked in Samana Bay and stumbled on to Bannister's ship. And that got the men to thinking. Phipps had gone to Samana Bay to trade with locals on his way to search for the lost galleon Concepcion. That meant there had to be hundreds of natives living in the area at the time, and it was near certain that some, or even most of them, had witnessed the battle between Bannister's pirates and the Royal Navy. Since Hispaniola belonged to the Spanish at the time, reports of the battle might have been filed with authorities back in Spain. "I know where to get those reports," Matera told Chatterton. "Buy me dinner at Fabio's and I'll tell you." A few hours later, Matera laid out his plan. A few days after that, he was on a plane headed for Madrid. Matera enjoyed few luxuries more than Europe's high-speed trains, and he spent most of the 2.5-hour ride from Madrid to Seville gazing out the window, watching olive plantations and rust-colored soil fly past him at nearly 200 miles per hour. In the deliberate rhythms of a speeding train, he did his best thinking, and his thoughts now were that he'd done the right thing to come looking for his English pirate in Spain. In Seville, Matera caught a taxi to the General Archive of the Indies. Standing at the entrance to the grand building, which dated to 1584, he imagined couriers arriving on horseback, delivering documents written by explorers, conquistadors, and shipwreck survivors. He'd been here before, researching treasure ships and dreaming of gold. He was lost within moments of walking in the door. The grand building contained hundreds of thousands of documents, comprising more than 80 million pages of original papers, each of which seemed as likely a starting place as any other. He drifted like a boat cut from its line until an attractive woman in her 30s tapped him on the shoulder. She introduced herself as an archivist and asked, in good English, if she could help. "Yes, I'm looking for—" Matera's voice boomed off the cavernous interior. He toned down to a whisper. "I'm looking for any reports from Samana Bay on the northern coast of Hispaniola from June 1686 to around June 1688. It can be from merchants." Matera figured that any account of the battle would have reached Spain before a year had passed. He added an extra year to make sure he didn't miss anything.
"Are you a treasure hunter?" she asked.
No one had ever asked Matera that question. "I guess I am," he replied. The archivist smiled, then led Matera through the building, taking him past floor-to-ceiling shelves of documents and papers. Only a small part of the collection, she said, had been catalogued on computer or copied to microfiche. The rest was available only by hand, as it had been for hundreds of years. The secrets to the galleons were here. Yet Matera saw little security, and he always noticed security. It had been his life's work until now. The woman helped Matera comb through old books and folders. She parked him at a table that looked as long as a football field and left him alone with the documents, some of which hadn't been handled in centuries. For hours, Matera worked at that table, searching for mention of Bannister or pirates or a battle involving Navy ships. The archivist checked on him often, translating strange and curly-cued words written in old Spanish, bringing him more binders. She read passages aloud to him, an account of a passenger making a confession to clergy as a hurricane pummeled her ship, a navigator's doubts about his captain's decision, a crewman's fear that nearby lands were inhabited by cannibals. All dramatic and fascinating, but not what Matera was looking for. The next morning, Matera was first in the door, but his friend hadn't yet arrived, so he made a journey. And it was a journey in this place, to a section he'd visited the last time he was here, when he was researching lost galleons that he and Chatterton might pursue. That was in the early days of their partnership, when they dreamed in the hundreds of millions of dollars and sunken Spanish treasure ships called to them from across oceans. Retracing his previous steps, he found his way to a binder that contained information on his favorite of all the lost Spanish galleons, the San Miguel. She'd sunk in a storm in 1551, one of the earliest of Spain's great treasure ships to go down, and was carrying mostly gold, not silver. That alone had been enough to capture Matera's attention, but it was the contraband that gripped him. According to Matera's earlier research, it was likely that the San Miguel also hauled priceless Inca and Aztec treasures to be sold on the lucrative European black market by the conquistadors who'd stolen them. That didn't surprise Matera. He'd grown up among thieves and smugglers, some of them legendary. He knew what it meant to have a license to steal. By his estimate, the San Miguel's cargo was worth at least $500 million. Given the ship's history, he thought it might eclipse even the famous Atocha discovered by Mel Fisher off Key West in 1985. Most intriguing of all, he believed the ship sank near Samana Bay, in waters leased by Bowden. As far as he knew, Bowden had never searched in earnest for her. Thumbing through the file on the San Miguel brought back memories for Matera. The last time he'd been here, he'd believed nothing could pull him away from his dream of finding a lost galleon. Now he put the papers back in order and replaced them on the shelf. There were still answers in this file on the San Miguel. He could feel it. But his archivist friend had arrived, and he had a great pirate to go find. Matera pored over more binders and folders. By afternoon, it had become clear to him that he was not going to find any Spanish mention of Bannister's ship. Still, he read through every document, looking for any timely reference to pirate ships. He found a few, but none that could be linked to the Golden Fleece. By day's end, he was exhausted, and he still had a train to catch for Madrid that evening. On his way out, he stopped by the archivist's desk, where he reached into his bag and gave her a small, tissue-wrapped gift. It was a ceramic tile, about 10 inches square, painted with Salvador Dalí's figure at a window. It showed a young woman gazing out over the bay of a Spanish seaside town. Matera had always loved the painting because the girl seemed hopeful, like she knew something beautiful was coming, even if she couldn't see what it was at the moment. Matera felt that way inside libraries and archives. He'd always been able to depend on these places, to find stories that moved him, to rescue him from a dangerous life. Waving goodbye to his friend, he worried for himself. Before Bannister, he'd believed there was nothing he couldn't see if only he found the right window. Now, it seemed, he was running out of light. Chapter 9. John Matera. Waiting for Jacques Cousteau. Everyone kissed in John Matera's family. His father kissed his three sons when they visited him in his butcher shop. His mother Anne kissed the kids when they came home on the bus from Holy Rosary Catholic Grammar School. John's two younger brothers kissed him when he lent them his baseball glove. Once, after an insurance man made a cold call at the house, John kissed him goodbye. That was the way in the South Beach neighborhood on the east shore of Staten Island, a community of Italian and Irish families, and in the late 1960s, one of the safest places in New York. Ladies could walk home at midnight by themselves. Homeowners left their front doors unlocked. The South Beach area was home to some of the highest-ranking figures in the Gambino crime family, the most powerful mafia family in the country. Gambino boss Paul Castellano lived 2 miles from John. Underboss Aniello Della Croce's house was just down the street. These men and their world seemed as natural a part of the landscape to John as the cement ball field at the American Legion Post or the sand flats on Mills Avenue. In line at the supermarket, he heard ladies talk about loyalty. Riding the school bus, he heard kids discussing respect. Men with nice haircuts and new cars met for breakfast at local diners, even in the late afternoon. John's father, John Sr., worked more than 70 hours a week at Maddie's Quality Meats, the butcher shop he owned on Highland Boulevard, but he would still play catch every day with John and his brothers in the backyard. John loved the stories of his father's childhood, especially those about fighting his way through the Prospect Park section of Brooklyn. As the only Italian in the neighborhood, he'd learned to use his fists and wits to survive. "Me and you together back then," John's dad would say to him, "no one could have beat us." After grade school one day, John and some friends threw a smoke bomb into a local coffee shop. Cutting through the neighborhood, John was on the verge of a perfect getaway when a dark blue Lincoln Continental cut him off. Glaring at him from the driver's seat was Tommy Bilotti, a captain in the Gambino family with a reputation for being the toughest guy in a very tough neighborhood. "Come here," Bilotti ordered. John walked up to the window, panting.
"Did you do that at the restaurant?"
"Yeah."
"Why'd you do that?"
"I don't know."
Bilotti glared at John. Even at age 8, John had heard stories about what Bilotti did to people who did bad things.
"You Maddie's son?"
"Yeah."
"Then get the fuck out of here. Go!"
John ran faster than he could ever remember moving, but even as the wind blew in his face and his feet flew above the ground, he understood that the bad guys who lived nearby had power and could do things the police or even his father couldn't, and that they cared about respect. He knew that for sure because he wouldn't still be running if Tommy Bilotti didn't respect his dad. John's parents paid good money for him to attend Catholic school, but by second grade, it was clear John wasn't making the most of his opportunity. Yet on many days after school, when his friends went to shoot baskets or trade baseball cards, John rode his green Schwinn pea picker to the two-room South Beach branch of the New York Public Library, where he immersed himself in history books, especially those on the Revolutionary War. He loved the idea of the underdog rising up against the king. What guts that took! And even though kids teased him for spending time that way, he forgave them, because they didn't know the stories hiding inside that tiny building. One night, John's father sat him down in front of the television, poured a bowl of Wise potato chips, and showed him a new program. It featured mini submarines, scuba divers, exotic fish, a giant boat, seaplanes, foreign accents, underwater dirigibles, faraway lands, helicopters, dashing music, and a great white shark, and that was all in the first 2 minutes. This was the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau. From that day forward, John never missed an episode, planning not just his days, but his months around the new ones. Cousteau's world and his journey around the globe on the ship Calypso were a leap into history, danger, daring, mystery, and new worlds all at once. Most kids who loved Cousteau wished they could be on an adventure like that. What John wished for more than anything was to be on an adventure like that with his father. But even at age 8, he worried about whether his dad would ever get that kind of chance. John Sr. worked 6.5 days a week, 12 or 13 hours a day. It gave John and his brothers a good life, but what kind of life did it give his dad? In fourth grade, John's class took a trip to Fort Wadsworth, a former military installation in the shadow of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. According to the tour guide, the place had figured in the Revolutionary War, which was all John needed to hear. Wherever he looked, he saw the ghosts of Patriot soldiers cleaning their muskets and pushing tobacco into their pipes, poised to defy the king. John hung on the guide's every word, but what he really wanted to know was how such a place could be here, just 6 blocks from his house. After school, John and his friends rode their bikes back to Fort Wadsworth, where they climbed and explored and imagined firing at enemies until the night had turned black and America had prevailed. And this is how John's life went for the next 4 or 5 years, enduring school, hitting the library or Fort Wadsworth, waiting for Jacques Cousteau. At 13, John took a job at a local florist's shop to supplement the money he made from working at the butcher shop his dad owned. Kids teased him about the flowers. He wondered why it wasn't in him to use his fists to silence bullies, like his father had. On the playground one day, several seventh graders, including Albert, the biggest kid in the school, started taunting John about carnations. He wanted to tell them that working at a florist's shop showed good character. Instead, he said, "I'm going to fight every one of you after altar boy practice Saturday morning at the top of the hill." His legs shook so badly he could hardly walk home. Saturday morning, John's father drove him to the fight. At the bottom of the hill, he put a hand on his son's shoulder. "You don't have to go." John got out of the car and walked up the hill. Albert was waiting along with several henchmen.
You ready?
John asked.
Yeah.
And John swung with fists that reached back to his father's childhood in Prospect Park, with arms that had lifted legs of veal since grade school, with the spirit of the soldiers at Fort Wadsworth and the determination of the crew of the Calypso, and he hit Albert square in the jaw, knocking him down. Then he walked back down the hill and got into his father's car. Tears streamed down his cheeks.
I won,
he told his dad. Ann Matera had grown up poor, and eating away from home had been a luxury for her as a girl, so it was with pleasure that she took her sons to Skippy's hot dog truck whenever it parked nearby. It was there that John spotted a sign on a shop advertising scuba diving lessons.
Go in and see what they say, Ann said.
John wolfed down the hot dog, wiped ketchup onion sauce from his mouth, and ran to the shop. Inside, he smelled the neoprene of new wetsuits and saw framed photos of divers. A man of about 30 looked up from the counter.
What's up, big time?
He asked.
I want to learn how to do scuba diving.
The man looked John up and down, especially his Catholic school uniform.
How old are you?
14.
He handed John an application, then provided the lowdown. His name was Floyd Van Name, and he owned the place, Divers Cove. Scuba lessons cost $40, no refunds. They lasted 16 weeks. Scuba was not for the timid, at least not the way Divers Cove did it. No refunds. He'd need a physical. His parents would have to sign the forms. Don't even think about signing yourself.
I don't care if you do wear a suit and tie. I'll know.
John nodded, started walking toward the door, then turned back.
You like Jacques Cousteau?
He asked Van Name.
What do you think?
After a summer of scuba lessons, arranging flowers, and boning out legs of veal, John began classes at St. Peter's Boys High School on Staten Island. His teachers were sharp and the resources excellent, but John's thinking was mostly underwater. At every chance he took the bus to Divers Cove, asking questions of veteran divers and handling equipment he'd have to work double shifts to afford. His checkout dive came on an old wooden shipwreck in Spring Lake, New Jersey. Down deep, he pried loose a glass bottle that looked to be more than 100 years old.
What wreck is this?
He asked Van Name after surfacing.
It's called the Spring Lake wreck. How did they know it was going to wreck in Spring Lake?
No, that's just what we call it. It's been here forever. No one knows its real name.
At school, teachers continued to pile on homework, but John was at work on a bigger problem. Using microfiche, periodical guides, and finally an old Collier's magazine, he pieced together a solution which he wrote on an index card and took to the dive shop.
You know that wreck in Spring Lake? He asked Van Name.
What about it?
It was an old merchant ship, sunk in 1853. Her name is the Western World.
Sophomore year began with fists flying. Seniors on the baseball and wrestling teams had heard about John's reputation for toughness and decided to relieve him of it. John pounded each of them. By Christmas, he had been suspended 3 times for fighting. One person who noticed was a freshman named John Bellotti. He and John had always liked each other, but this was the first time they'd attended the same school. It was John Bellotti's father, Tommy, who had cut off John's escape route after he'd thrown a smoke bomb in the coffee shop. Tommy Bellotti had enjoyed a big rise in the ranks of the Gambinos since then and was now one of the most feared gangsters in all of New York. One day, John and John Bellotti got to talking. There were kids at school who needed money for cars, girls, concert tickets. Each of the boys had saved cash from working. There was no reason they couldn't lend it to classmates. They could charge the going rate in South Beach, 4 points a week, with the principal due after 26 weeks. They started by lending a few bucks, 50 here, 100 there, and that went well, so they branched out. If their old men found out, there would be trouble. Neither father wanted his son earning money that way, but by now, customers were coming to them. After a few months, John was earning hundreds a week, By the end of sophomore year, John and his friend were collecting on tens of thousands of dollars in loans. And it was a sweet business. They didn't have to break legs or make threats. People just paid them back. But the business really took off.